So today in the morning you said that there are different schools who say we should inquire, and then they stop and say we cannot. How is it that Sri Aurobindo didn't say that we cannot? Was it by some mundane means of knowledge only that he continued his inquiry? Or was it that because he has some extra mundane means of knowledge, therefore he could continue his inquiry, otherwise he would have also stopped like others? So was it due to extra means of knowledge which were available to him?
Well, it is true that in order to inquire into the full realm of philosophies, you need to have recourse to supraphysical means of knowledge. Philosophy is an intellectual inquiry. But that inquiry, at a given stage, has to open up to the data which are available by supraphysical means. And if that is not done, the promise of philosophy cannot be fulfilled. So, these philosophers, they refuse to maintain that there are any other means of knowledge. That is a problem. If they inquire and they want to inquire, they should say we shall inquire by whatever means we can inquire. As I read out from Bertrand Russell's statement, he says, we admit that there are very important questions which we need to answer, but we refuse to believe that there are higher means of knowledge by means of which these questions can be answered. So what is the ground of this refusal? That is where the problem lies. How can you, ab initio say there are no other means of knowledge? That is why in India, fortunately, Shabda Pramana was admitted as a means of knowledge. And Shabda Pramana is not the authority of the text, but the authority of the statements made available to mankind through supraphysical means of knowledge. So since Shabda is not in the epistemology of these thinkers, therefore their philosophy can never be complete. And this has been the main problem throughout the history of Western philosophy. Even Plato, for example, whenever he has been able to give very profound answers, it was by recourse to the tradition of Orpheus, Eleusinian and Orphean traditions, which were supraphysical. So that is why this problem lies here. If they are to say we cannot answer, that is enough. Quite all right. But they say we refuse to believe that there are other means. That is the main problem. How can you refuse? And that is the problem. Without recourse to supraphysical means, you cannot collect all the data which are necessary for philosophy.
Sir, but isn't it that even if you have Indian philosophers like Shankaracharya, in the realm of Maya, in case of Maya, it appears to me that he has refused to investigate into the nature of Maya, by saying that Maya cannot be inquired into. Tadeva Mayaya Mayatvam Yad Tark Asahishrutvam. That is what Shankar says. That since it cannot be tested on arguments, on Tark, this is the very Mayatva of Maya. It is, to my mind, refusing to inquire after a particular limit.
Yeah, right.
Even though Shankaracharya did believe in extra physical means, so in that case also he refuses to inquire after a limit.
You see, there is a, you might say, opportunistic position of Shankaracharya. There are many things which he admits on Shabda Pramana. And those things he subjects also to intellectual discussion. On what ground does he say that the nature of Maya cannot be subjected to intellectual inquiry? On what basis? Neither on Shabda Pramana. Shabda Pramana doesn't say that Maya cannot be subjected to inquiry by intellectual means. So on what basis did he say this?
That is to say, he refused to inquire, that comes to that.
Quite right.
That's not that.
Therefore his answer is opportunistic answer. He has given some reason,
yes,
which for the sake of occasion, it works. People won't discuss further.
But
looks very clever answer.
I see.
That I don't discuss it because intellectually I will not be able to discuss it. Why? He does not show why it cannot be discussed intellectually.
Because such is the nature of Maya.
Why? How do you know that, that such is the nature of Maya?
Because I have applied my mind and found that
that is it. That is it. So he has not shown how it is applied, how he has found it, that he has not expounded. He only says, I have tried, I have failed, so I don't want to disturb you now. That's why I call it an opportunistic answer. Indian philosophers are not free from opportunism. Whenever it suits them, they have contrived some answer. Although they rely upon Shabda quite often, whenever it is convenient to them, they have contrived, like Madhvacharya, Tattvamasi. It's an Upanishadic Shabda, identity of myself with the divine. Here is a statement which contradicts dualism. So, there is an opportunistic answer. Tattvamasi means you are in that. Not you are that, but you are in that. Now how do you bring out that meaning? Then they say, look at the grammar. Sometimes we do say, the thing is in that. You identify it and say, it is that. It's a contrivance, purely opportunistic contrivance. There is no hard and fast rule that tattvamasi can ever mean that you are in that. But it suits his philosophical position. So he says tattvamasi has to be understood in this light.
But sir, I suppose that there is a Shabda Pramana in Indian tradition which says that there are things which are beyond logic. Naishamatis tarkena apaneya kathopanishad, for example. And if Shankar and other philosophers stop their inquiry, logical inquiry at a particular period and say, well, here is an authority of the scripture which says that there are things which are beyond logic and therefore we are not reasoning about it. They can say it on the basis of Shabda Pramana.
In science, there is a problem of qualia. In qualia, they say that the most basic thing cannot be expressed or explained. For example, redness of red. So if somebody shows me red, I know it is red. But how do I explain or express the redness of red? So they say that it is the problem of qualia. It can be known, but cannot be expressed.
That is true. But this question is slightly different from this.
Yeah.
Slightly. I mean, there is a point of view which is correct. But take, for example, a statement that the nature of reality is formless. Now, formless can neither be seen nor can be conceived. It is a word. Those who experienced it, they say it is formless. Now, such a statement, if you say that, well, tell me how is formless formless? You have got to say it is to be experienced. It cannot be expressed further. But I can distinguish it from form. Therefore, intellectually it can be grasped. In that sense. So, in the case of red, you go still further. But in the case of formless, you can say by contrast to form, you can understand it. That reality, wherever there is form, it is other than that. So, in the case of red, you can't say it is other than the green. Because even green also remains unanswered. What is green? So, in the case of that qualia, it is still a deeper point. Formless is not of that kind. Because formless can be contrasted with the form which you and I can see. Therefore, I can have some distinguishing mark. Wherever there is form, it is not that reality of which I am speaking. That much can be said.
When we say we can understand, what do we mean? Because generally what we conceive of understanding is, it's like I can intellectually comprehend. So I understand. So when we say we can understand formlessness, what exactly do we mean?
There is, first of all, understanding through a concept which has an image in it. These concepts can be understood where there is an image. When I say divine is love, I can understand it to some extent. Although I can say it is not human love. Sri Krishna's love is not a human love. But still, it is not quietude. Whatever that love may be, that love is not quiet. It is love. It is not mercy. It's not even compassion. So, it has certainly something of which you know as love. We all can have a concept of that experience of love, which is not human, but that warmth of love, which even though you may say it is divine, I can understand it must have that warmth. Therefore, you can say love is conceivable. Take for example, it is said reality is ineffable. It can't be expressed. It is true, reality is ineffable. And yet you can say reality is Satchidananda. Now these three words, Satchidananda, they are words. Now that Sat, what is that Sat? Even that you may say, I don't understand. Because whatever you say, it is not Sat like this. This also is existing. But that Sat is not like this. But there is one idea of Sat which certainly applies to it. It is that into which you knock. Satchidananda is such a thing that it is inescapable. It is something that blocks you. When you experience Satchidananda, you do know that there is something here which you can't escape. It is like supposing you have worn a cap here and you feel the cap's presence here. It is that into which you knock. Now, Satchidananda is a reality into which you knock. It may not be like this. So, when you say Sat, it is understandable, it is conceivable. There is some experience that you can switch off. It is something that is inescapable. Satchidananda is an experience. You feel that you are knocked into it. In fact, that is the real experience of existence. Once you say, it exists, what does it mean? This table exists, if there is darkness, and I say, look, wait, take care, there is a table in it. Now, I know there is a table only when I knock into it. I cannot penetrate into it. It is there. It subsists. Now, this is the minimum concept of Sat. That which is in which you knock, it arrests you. It is inescapable. You can't pass through it. It is impossible. You find, as it were, a presence. Many mystics, for example, speak of the presence of the divine. What is that presence that you see? It is exactly this, impossible. It is surely different from there being nothing. That which is nothing, is nothing, there is no experience of any kind at all. Here there is an experience of a presence which you cannot avoid. It is there. Wherever you turn, you find, my Lord, He is here, He is here, He is here, He is here. That is the experience of the presence of the Divine. So, in any case, Satchidananda, these three terms, are terms through which we conceive that reality. Reality in itself is ineffable. But these three terms in Indian philosophy are expressive of that ineffable reality. Chit, for example, the consciousness of the divine is quite different from my understanding of consciousness. But in my experience also, I do know the difference between awareness and the thing of which I am aware. This distinction I know in my own consciousness. Therefore, I can see that if that reality is described as chit, it is something similar to my consciousness which takes cognizance of a thing of which I am aware. It's a cognizing quality in it. So to that extent, I can say I understand what is chit. There is a capacity of cognition. Similarly, Ananda, as I told you, we do not know what is divine love or divine Ananda, but I do know pleasure, for example. And I can say that, well, divine is not pleasure of the kind that I have when I eat ice cream. It's not that pleasure. But there is something in the pleasure which is different from awareness. To be aware of a thing and to be pleasant about it, there's a difference between the two. I can be aware without being pleasant. So that experience of pleasantness is certainly present in it. However rarefied it may be, however transcendent it may be, but there is something of it which I can conceive. That is why you can say ultimate reality, although ineffable, can be discussed. Otherwise, there will be no discussion about ultimate reality at all. And some philosophers do maintain, of which you cannot speak, you should remain silent. This was Wittgenstein who said, you should not discuss philosophical matters, because philosophy deals with those things which are ineffable. Then how can you discuss? You can discuss them, because reality, even though ineffable, that reality itself expresses itself in some kind of experiences. It's not entirely incapable of expressions. On their ground, philosophy becomes possible. That is why I can discuss whether God is omnipotent or omniscient. Why, how can I discuss omniscience of God, tell me? One thing is certain, omniscience means I am aware of everything. Whatever that omniscience may mean, I have never experienced what is omniscience, but it is something in which I can take cognizance. So when I say, if God is omniscient, does he know what is to happen tomorrow? I can raise this question quite validly. Does he know what is to happen tomorrow? And if I know what is to happen tomorrow, he is not omnipotent. He can't change it tomorrow. If he is omnipotent, he should be able to change tomorrow also. But if he knows already what is to happen tomorrow, he is bound by his omniscience. Therefore, he is not omnipotent. I can discuss this question on these grounds, on the basis of what I can understand out of it. Therefore, philosophical objects can be discussed. In any case, Satchidananda is a great formulation by Indian philosophers, on the basis of which philosophers have been able to discuss about ultimate reality. Similarly, the definition of God as peace is understandable. God as love is understandable. If these were not understandable, philosophy, you should have simply said, there is no need at all of discussion. Why there is so much of difficulty about problem of evil? If you say God is love, how can there be evil in this world? Does not God know that I am now going to be attacked by evil forces? And if he is truly my lover, he should be protecting me. I discuss this question quite well. And therefore I say that if there is God, there can't be evil. He will show there is no God. I don't believe God as a lover. You can discuss it. And theologians have a difficult time to discuss this problem, because they want to see both omnipotent and love and everything. Otherwise these discussions would become futile. Right from the beginning you can say objects of philosophy are incapable of being discussed. In fact, there is a philosopher, a living philosopher called Hick, John Hick. He says conflict of religions arise out of descriptions of God. According to Islam, God is just. According to Christianity, God is love. Therefore, there's a conflict. Justice and love, they collide with each other. Therefore, Christians say, we don't accept Islamic concept of God. And vice versa. Therefore, Hicks says, my answer to both of them is the following. You don't know what is justice. It is ineffable. You don't know what is love. It is ineffable. Stop quarreling. You simply say it is ineffable reality. Therefore, your conflict will cease. Now, if it was so simple as that, there would have been no problem. But the problem is that it is not so easy as that. God is describable. God is not entirely ineffable. God is describable. See, there is, if you open the second chapter of the second volume,
Brahma Purush Ishwar.
Yes, if you open the chapter and see the second paragraph.
But although this thing terminable to minds, because of its absoluteness and infinity, we discovered that the supreme and eternal infinite determined itself in our consciousness in the universe by real and fundamental truths of its being, which are beyond the universe and in it, and are the very foundation of its existence.
Further.
These truths present themselves to our conceptual cognition as the fundamental aspects in which we see and experience the omnipresent reality. In themselves, they are seized directly, not by intellectual understanding, but by a spiritual intuition, a spiritual experience in the very substance of our consciousness. But they can also be caught as in conception by a large and plastic idea, and can be expressed in some sort of a plastic sphere, which does not insist too much on rigid definition or limit the wideness and subtlety of the idea in order to express the experience, this experience or this idea with any nearness a language has to be creative, which is at once intuitively metaphysical and revealingly poetic, admitting significant and living images as the vehicle of a close, suggestive and vivid indication. A language such as we find hammered out into a subtle and pregnant massiveness in the Ved and the Upanishads. In the ordinary tongue of metaphysical thought, we have to be content with a distant indication, an approximation by abstractness, which may still be of some service to our intellect, for it is this kind of speech which suits our method of logical and rational understanding. But if it is to be of real service, the intellect must consent to pass out of the bounds of a finite logic and accustom itself to the logic of the infinite, on the condition alone, by this way of seeing and thinking, it ceases to be paradoxical or futile to speak of the ineffable. But if we insist on applying a finite logic to the infinite, the omnipresent reality will escape us, and we shall grasp instead an abstract shadow, a dead form petrified into speech, or a hard, incisive graph which speaks of the reality but does not express it. Our way of knowing must be appropriate to that which is to be known. Otherwise, we achieve only a distant speculation, a figure of knowledge, and not veritable knowledge.
This is actually the real position of Sri Aurobindo, that it is not paradoxical to speak of the ineffable. Ineffable, by definition, is that it cannot be spoken of. And yet philosophy is nothing but speaking about the ineffable. Why? How can you then speak of the ineffable? Because there are certain large and plastic ideas about the reality which you can grasp intellectually. But while discussing, you should take care that you are speaking of the ineffable. This is a position that is in between two positions. According to one position, reality can be fully described with precise terms. The other is, this reality cannot be described at all. What Sri Aurobindo says is that reality can be described in large and plastic ideas. And while you discuss, you should remember constantly that you are discussing something that is not ordinarily understood in the way in which you understand that. Take for example, I said divine love. Normally I expect divine love means that one who takes care, minimum. Lover is one who takes care of, nourishes me, fosters. And then I see that divine is sending me to gallows. He's present there. And then I shout, where is God's love? Now what have I done? I'm applying the word love to mean the same thing as a human being would do to me. I must strive that is there anything by which I can understand that God is fostering me by sending me to gallows? That may be. So, my being sent to the gallows, if I really try to understand, I understand better. As Sri Aurobindo cried out, oh Lord, why do you send me to the jail? I thought I had a lot of work to do and that you will protect me. And now you are sending me to jail. Of course, he's not doubt his love, but he asks his question, what are you doing? And then the first answer he got was that he waited. He waited patiently. Then Sri Krishna answered, that I have told you, withdraw from your activity for the moment. You did not obey me. Then I love you very much. I want to tell you something which you can only hear me only if you are in solitude and not only for 5 minutes, but for a long time. Certain amount of time I want to spend with you. And you were not willing to do it. And I love you rather very much. So I told those policemen and said, you now go there and at night you go to him. Otherwise he knows law quite well, he will try to escape. At night you will get no other help, so you got to take him into the police thana at night and put him into jail. I want to meet him, I want to embrace him, I want to talk to him. I want to give a great message to him. Now if you understand, so I should go by saying that divine is love. But by love, when you discuss with somebody, you should say, love means one who takes care. How do you know that he doesn't take care of you? It's true, he's sending you to the gallows. Danton was guillotined. Why was he guillotined? Because, as Sri Aurobindo says, although he was the soul of French Revolution, a time came. Mahakali was doing a great destruction. And he went to Mahakali and said, stop, 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 stop. So Mahakali simply slung him aside. Get out from here. Jirasin then finished. It was his love, her love. You wanted revolution. I came for revolution. I love you so much. And now you tell me to stop. You have betrayed yourself. Now get out of this. I put you aside. And he was reluctant. Now is that any injustice done by Kali? She came at his invitation. And she was doing her great work for his sake. And now he says, stop, 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 don't do it. You have too much. This Kali force is too much. So Sri Aurobindo has written that Dato had to be put aside. Because he, Mahakali's force was being stopped by him. If you understand love in that sense, you can say, that love is not that love which you expect from beloved who sit in the boat and, and sail in the beautiful sunshine or moonshine. It's not that love. So while discussing love, you must remember that you are using the word love in a plastic and that kind of understanding you should have. When it baffles you, you ask yourself, am I really going to be truthful? Am I not unauthorizedly using my terms, my understanding of that in a favor? On that condition, Sri Aurobindo says, on that condition, philosophical speculation about reality must be held. When you say divine is peace, fine. Vivekananda went to America and he wrote, did you oppose the peace of the divine? Divine is peace. And he rolled in the parliament of religions. What is that peace of which he spoke? That peace is not a peace of which we understand, that if you are peaceful, you can't speak. That peace is that which is capable of remaining even when you roar. That is the meaning of peace. And that is, you must understand, Jastra Shemana says, that when you use these terms, you should always keep in mind that you are not using these terms in the way in which you ordinarily use them. And yet, there is justification of speech. There is a distinction between peace and noise. There is a distinction, even in the divine consciousness. But that distinction is not seizable by ordinary experience. As Sri Aurobindo says, these words are indicative. They are not binding. And this is a very important distinction. They indicate the reality, the nature of reality, but they don't bind you. And said, now you have said God is infinite. Fine, very good. If He is infinite, I just space. God is also space. It is all finitude everywhere. Therefore, God cannot be space. God cannot be time. Sri Aurobindo says that you are dealing with a reality which can be at once infinite and finite. When the Anand Saraswati says God cannot take birth in a human body, he is using only one kind of logic. How can you say divine cannot take birth in a human body? Actually, everyone is an avatar in a sense because God is present everywhere. In every human body he is present. If he can be present in every body, why can he not be special in one body? This is the difficulty of people who don't use the words about God rightly. So Sri Aurobindo says, philosophical discussion is possible, is permissible. You can have philosophical speculation, provided that this condition is fulfilled. Whenever you try to describe the reality, you try to describe him in large and plastic ideas. That's why Sri Aurobindo says that this feat was committed by Upanishads and the Vedas. That the terms which were hammered out by the Vedas and Upanishads are wonderful hammering out, like the word Brahma, for example. The very word Brahman at once expresses the essence and manifestation. It's a very important word, Brahma. Brahma means what? The very word is, the very word Brahman is essence and manifestation. The two concepts are both caught in this word. It's neither in the word God or any way. It is Brahma, because etymologically itself, Brahma means their expansion. And expansion can be of that which is absolutely unexpounded. You can expand only which is unexpounded. So, that which is the essence which is expanded is the word Brahma. Such a word has been coined in India to describe the ultimate reality. A word which has no comparison anywhere in any language. A word which exactly expresses the essence capable of manifestation. The very word itself gives you the meaning of it. The very word itself is plastic. It means essence also, it means manifestation also, it means both at the same time. The plasticity of the meaning is contained in the word Brahma. So, these words have been coined, as it were, by superb messenry of the Vedic rishis to describe the reality. And this is why in Indian philosophy, although now we are confusing all the time, Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, we use the terms pell-mell. But if you go to the original meaning of Brahma, this is the only meaning in which you should use. Brahma is that which is essence and which manifests, expands. But by Brahma is not meant Ishvara. The idea of lordship is not expressed by Brahma. Therefore, another word was chosen by them, Ishvara. The meaning of Brahma as essence, as the origin of expansion, is not given in the word Brahma. So a third word was used, the Purusha. So when you want to use the reality as the origin, then you should use the word Purusha as the origin. So the word origin is indicated by the word Purusha. Because what is Purusha? Purusha is actually, Pur is a town, field, in which one dwells. The one who creates, who originates a field in which he dwells is Purusha. Now, in the word Brahma, it is only essence and expansion. But this idea that he creates a field, originates a field in which he can dwell. So if you want to describe that reality, how will you describe it? So word Purusha was coined for that. So you can find that these three words actually describe the reality fully. The essence which can manifest, can create a field in which he dwells, and he also lords over it. Now, if you want to express all the three words, three senses, you say the reality is Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara. Then you get the full sense of the idea of reality. And according to Upanishad, reality is all the three. But each one has its own specific meaning. And therefore, in the Upanishad, these three words are used at the right time in the right manner. You see, the word Purusha was used in the Veda. The whole Purusha Sukta is a Sukta which gives you origination of the universe. That's very important. Purusha Sukta is a Sukta where divine as an originator of the universe is described. Prajapati is not used because Prajapati is the Lord. Ishwara is the Lord. But that is not Purusha. Brahmanaspati, you know, Brahma is not used in the Veda, but Brahmanaspati is there. It is expressive power, power of expression. There is Brahmanaspati, the Lord of expression. So these words which have been used in the Veda are very significant words. And Sri Aurobindo says that this Veda and the Upanishads have hammered out very plastic words. So that you don't confuse one with the other. And you say reality is Brahman, Purusha, Ishwara. Now you can have no quarrel. Because you can't say God is only the creator. Therefore many problems which arise out of creation, they don't apply to him because he is also the Lord of it. It is all the manifestations also of himself. Many problems in theology have arisen because you conceive of God only as a creator. Or only as the Lord. But you, very often in the most of the religions, God is not regarded as the substance of the world. He is not himself expressed in the world. He is a creator, but creates out of what? Out of nothing, according to Christian Islam. Out of nothing. So he doesn't create out of himself. But here in the Upanishad, the world is itself an expression of the Brahman. So many of the controversies which arise in many other philosophies, they do not immediately apply to this Upanishadic idea of the reality. So Sri Aurobindo says that ineffable does not mean that you can't talk about it at all. If that was so, then all life divine can't be written at all, finished. All the philosophical discussions take place because there are concepts in which reality is can be caught. You can try to understand. Philosophy is an attempt to understand ineffable. But therefore it is not absolutely ununderstandable. Therefore Sri Aurobindo says that although they can also be experienced, but it can't be said that it cannot be caught in the intellectual concept at all. They are not entirely like red. They can be distinguishable. There are distinguishing marks. And by distinctions and by some kind of an image, you can understand them. And because of that reason, such huge books can be written. Otherwise, this won't be possible. Otherwise you will take the position of Hick, as I said. Why do you quarrel? There is, God cannot be expressed at all, so finished. Don't discuss it. And religionists will never accept that position. They will say, we know God quite well. It has been revealed. God is omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, His love, His justice, His mercy, His forgiveness. All these things are given, so we cannot say, you can't describe Him at all.
What is the use to discuss something which is ineffable, even in plastic terms? How does it benefit an individual, or how does it benefit people who actually discuss God? Is it like a good time pass?
No. You are walking on a path. You ask somebody, I want to go to this town. This direction or that direction? He indicates to you this way. Does it help you?
Not completely, but it does.
That's right. That is the only use of philosophy. Philosophy is indicating, as Sri Aurobindo says also,
you should take all philosophical terms as indications. When I say God is love and he can send me to gallows, my consciousness becomes very wide. I understand it. I don't grumble if I'm sent to jail or to gallows. I say, what a grace of God, I am now sent to gallows. I can say that. My God is loving me so much. You know, it is said that when you read some of the great tragedies, you find a great sympathy for the author. The author describes a situation and the conditions develop. And the hero is in a great impasse. Can't go this way, can't go that way, can't go this way. And somebody comes and kills him. You feel how nice. Man is now completely protected from any problem now before him. He was facing an impossible problem. And the solution has come. When you read tragedies, really, you find the only solution for him is to now disappear from the field. This is the rasa of a drama. Even in tragedy, karuna, a drama becomes karunanta, and a real karunanta is this tragedy. Tragedy, a good tragedy is one where the reader is led to sympathize with the author in allowing the hero to be off the scene. There is no solution for the problem. He has got to disappear. And then he disappears. What more can we do? Othello kills himself ultimately. What more can he do? He has murdered his wife without any fault, maybe under wrong impression. And now that impression is gone, he has been brought to the truth. How can he look upon himself? How will he live? Better he disappears from the scene altogether. So, in the same way, philosophy, when you are told God is love, and when you see that God is not acting with you as if he is loving you, then there is indication to you. My dear friend, think about it. Don't grumble. Don't grudge. See what is being done for you. See how you are uplifted. How you are carried. That now he is not only accompanying you, he is carrying you on his shoulder. See how he is carrying you. Now this message will come to you if you really have a true philosophical concept. If you are only told God is ineffable, then even this indication will not come to you. It is no helpful to you at all. God is ineffable. So when you are in difficulty, ineffable doesn't help you at all.
Why do things take time? Why anything takes time? Why do we have to go through a process? Process and then space and time. All the churning and everything has to go through it. And then you have to come to see philosophy with my dear friend. All this churning. Love of God expressed in another peculiar way. So why do things take time?
But there can be three answers to this question. One is that you made a contract with God. Please allow me time. So God says, all right. You have wanted time, I'll give you time. Because it is true that if that contract is not there, and you say to God this very moment, Vinti, as Kali came to Sri Ramakrishna on the spot, he said, if you don't manifest, I'll kill myself. Right now I want you. She came. So, my first answer is that you have asked God, please give me time. I want to walk in the garden of life. So, you kindly wait for me. The second reason is that time is a measure for the growth. Question is, what do you want as a result of the growth? Different fruits take different times. The mango tree does not grow very fast. Some other fruits come very fast. The worms germinate very quickly. Other species, embryonic growth takes time. So depends upon what kind of fruit is being grown. What kind of fruit? So depends on that. So second reason, the kind of fruit that you want. The third reason is that there is an experience that is required. You know, for example, we were hearing today the Jodha Akbar's music. If that music was given in 2 minutes' time, it would not be so enjoyable. It's only all the harmonies and tunes are combined together. It's the minimum time actually, because cinema songs do not allow too much time. Ultimately, in 3 minutes, the whole song is finished. But even these 3 minutes are all filled with all kinds of tunings. So, the experience that is required, there is a kind of a rhythm. And rhythm is measurement of time. So, if certain things are done too quickly, you won't enjoy yourself. You require some rhythm. If you want to enjoy the dance, you should start with small tap. Tap here, tap there, first of all. And then gradually you come to the right tempo and then the climax. If you start with a climax, it won't give you that experience. So the intensity of experience requires time. So you might say that these are three reasons why time is required. And as I said, if you don't want time, that also is possible. It's not that it's not possible. Time can be given to you if you want it. Kind of fruit that you want, experience that you need, and the rapidity with which you want a result, all are available. In a sense, you might say, time is relative. As Einstein said, time is relative, it's a truth. It is relative. So that is any other question you have to say?
There is one question more. As far as I have known so far, the method of sadhana, which is according to scripture, should culminate in going beyond mind. Because as long as you are in the domain of mind, your experiences are limited. Going beyond mind, how to do it? I have two alternatives available to me. One is given by Patanjali Yoga Vastino, which even Sri Aurobindo experienced with the Nani. But he didn't stop. Whereas Patanjali would have said, well, Chittavachini Road is there, so this is the final stage. This is one thing, how we can perform sadhana and go beyond mind. This is one. The another way was given to me by yourself. Let thy will manifest. Which, if I concentrate on this sentence, would mean eliminating my ego. Unless my ego is saying, thy will cannot manifest, because his will should manifest, not my will.
Correct.
These are the two ways that I have known so far. My question is, of course those ways are must have been there in Integral Yoga and all that, but these are voluminous books. In sutra form, are there any other means of transcending mind? And secondly, is transcending mind the same thing as having supermind, or is there a difference between that?
Transcending mind has many steps. What Patanjali says, citta vritti nirodha, is to my mind not a very wise guidance. It's a definition, Shastric definition is all right. But it can't be given as a guidance. One has to be told, there is first of all cultivation of quietude of the mind. There's a difference between quietude of the mind, silencing the mind. Citta vritti nirodha is a complete silence of the mind. Where there is no ripple of any vibration of consciousness. There is quietude of the mind, in which there is an inner freedom from restlessness. Therefore, one of the first advices is not to transcend the mind just like this, but to say, be quiet. Then, there is a further condition of being calm. And there is a distinction between quietude and calm. Remain calm. In quietude, the state can be disturbed. In calmness, it's not very easy to disturb. Then there is a state of peace. You may be quiet, you may be calm, and yet not be peaceful. Because peacefulness comes when there is harmony of your being, there is no quarrel in your parts of being. Knowledge and will may be conflicting with each other. you may be quiet, but as long as this conflict goes on, you can't be at peace with yourself. As long as you think a work is still to be done and not yet done, you can remain quiet, calm, but not peaceful, because there is still a pressure and a pull towards completion of the work. He very often said he died peacefully. That happens when all that he wanted to do, he has seen, done, completed. There was no pull for him now. Nothing was left to be done. When we say, I went to sleep peacefully, I have done all the work that I had to do, it is over. I am a signal man in the train, for the train. The train has passed. My signal work is over. I go home now. Up to the next train coming, I have no work to do, completely at peace. What is to be done is done, accomplished. So peace is a condition of a great harmony of various parts of the being. Then silence. Why silence does not come to people so easily? Because there is a pull for something to be done. People may try and say, now, you force yourself to be silent. But there is a pull. This is to be still done. Very often when you start really meditating, you begin to calculate what is to be done, what is not to be done. All the ideas of what is remaining to be done comes to you forefront. He says, I had to give this account to this man. He had to give me this account. He has not given me. When I get up after 2 hours, I have to do this, I have to do that, planning. As a result, my mind does not become silent. Those people, like Sri Aurobindo, when he says in 3 days he attained silence, he had reached a point where psychologically he was absolutely satisfied that whatever he has to do is done. It is in that condition that silence can come so quickly, because to remain silent means that nothing further needs to be done after that. Nothing more is to be done. There is a complete silence. Therefore, as I said, advising somebody to be silent is not a very ordinary advice, and it is very unwise also. You force upon people to sit down and even make him irresponsible. Certain things are to be done, he doesn't do, and then there are problems and so on. So, these questions remain to be settled. So, your best thing is to tell people, learn to be quiet first. Under every circumstance, try to be quiet. Don't feel disturbed. Then to be calm. More and more, if you remain quiet for a long time, you don't get disturbed. Then even if alarming news comes to you, you remain calm. About some cricketers who say he's cool. That is, even alarming condition, he is not disturbed. You take in stride if something happens. Then be peaceful. And then you find out if anything remains for you to do. When you have something remains to be done, do not enter into silence. It's difficult for you to enter into silence. accomplish everything that you want to do. Then you sit down. You arrive at a point when you say, now nothing remains for me to do. I don't have to plan. I don't have to find the means of planning to be finished, how the work is to be accomplished. All this I don't need. I simply want to have, even when everything is now accomplished, still my mind is still flickering. Then you can say Chitta Vritti Nirodha. Therefore, normally one should not tell people, be silent, be silent. You can be silent suddenly. You are going to read a book. And I say for 3 minutes, be absolutely quiet. That you can do. Because you know, after 3 minutes you are going to open your eyes. So for 3 minutes, you can remain quiet. Such exercises you should do. Or for example, when you have contemplated on a problem and contemplated deeply on a problem, this contemplation automatically leads you to what is called a quiet experience in which silence can be heard. You become so quiet. You contemplate and contemplate and contemplate. Mind automatically falls. Very, very silent. But to think that now forever it will remain, even psychologically it is not possible. Even those people who claim to go to samadhi, they can remain in long state of samadhi. But unless one decides to leave the body in the state of samadhi, the moment you come back, there is this problem of dealing with your mind. And therefore, merely the path of silencing the mind is not enough. Sri Aurobindo speaks of 4 things to be done simultaneously. First, you cultivate your mind and its faculty, exercise your mind to develop the mental capacity to the fullness. Some people who only prescribe silencing the mind, they do prematurely without developing their mental faculty. As a result, when they come back from silence, they remain as screwed in mentality as anybody else, because the mind is not cultivated. Therefore, you should, whenever you are not in silence, you try to cultivate your mind. And do not complain yourself that I am only thinking, thinking, thinking. Don't worry. It's a part of your perfection. You are a philosopher. As a philosopher, you have got to develop your mental faculty, philosophical faculty, to its utmost sharpness. And Sri Aurobindo prescribes it. He says that this is necessary. Your instrument of buddhi should be cultivated to its fullness. Because even if you attain silence, you are bound to come back sometime. And the moment you come back, again your intellectual faculty will work.
And if he's not sharpened, you'll fall into that smaller rot. So this is one thing. Second, you should always try to think of the highest as much as possible. It's the second exercise. As you develop your objects of thought, more and more universal, more and more transcendental, your entire being of thought rises very high. This is the tantric method of, another way of saying, you try to reach Sahasrara. When you constantly strive yourself to think of the highest and to remain all the time in the highest level of consciousness, don't be petty, don't be mean. Be very generous in your heart. White. Have trust. Have trust God is there. He is looking after you. Have trust. Don't be afraid. This will happen, that will happen. What will happen? This consciousness, as a result of that, whole being will rise to the high level of Sahasrara, gradually. Ultimately, to be stationed in Sahasrara is also a necessary part of the sadhana. Thirdly, make your mind as obedient as practical. Normally, mind is not obedient. This is the big difficulty of the mind. Mind should be always made to be obedient. What I told you, let thy will be done, is actually sadhana of that kind. It's a part of this totality. Make your mind obedient. Human mind is very revolting. It wants to arrive at conclusions and wants to make oneself in the center of things. Which is good. I want to decide. You should decide. But always keep open to higher advice. And you should go to somebody saying, I want your advice. I want this, I must happen, this is my will. Don't go with that attitude. I want your advice. What do you say? First of all, you should go to somebody whom you think is higher than you. And when you go to him, you go to him with this, what is your will? What should I think to you? What is your advice? And the ideal is to tell God, that thy will be done, not mine. This is the third exercise. The fourth is to rise gradually from quietude to calmness, to peacefulness, and then silence. These four things, these four steps, by which it should climb. When you do all the four, then something else will happen. And that is answers now other question that you raise. That normally mind is the faculty by which we think we come to know. Actually, as Mother says, mind is not the faculty of knowledge. Mind is the faculty of organization. Mind is the faculty by which the ideas that are earned from all over are organized. You are
your machine mind is a machine of organizing. But ideas are borrowed from senses. Borrowed from ideas which are in the currency all around. Ideas which have been cultivated by me. Now all this is like a pot in which vegetables are cast for cooking. Mind is not the instrument of knowledge, but when you do this, then ideas now begin to pour from above, which normally doesn't happen. Normally all our ideas are gathered from sense experience, or from surroundings, or from speculations in which I am engaged. But when these four things begin to develop, then you begin to experience that ideas begin to pour from above. There is a level of consciousness in which knowledge already exists. That knowledge is in the form of an idea to start with. Those ideas begin to flow into you. These ideas can be called intuitive mental ideas. No more rational ideas, but intuitive mental ideas. You begin to have entry into intuitive mind. So there is a difference between the mind and the intuitive mind. Our ordinary mind is an ideative mind where ideas are derived from sense experiences, from the environment and from my own speculations. But intuitive idea is an idea which is coming from above and the source of which is knowledge. Here it is not knowledge. So I begin to have that idea. So this is our first experience of the intuitive idea. This is not yet super mind because this is only the intuitive mind. Then, these ideas begin to take the form of experience. There are no more ideas, but you begin to experience. God, for example, I may begin to have an idea of God. But when these exercises are done, then I begin to experience God's love. You really feel God's embrace. That love is a palpable experience of His embrace. You really feel the experience, the identity. This is called knowledge by identity. You really feel God caressing you. You really can embrace Him. You can sleep with Him. You can enjoy His presence. This is the experience. It is still a higher level. I mean, idea is no more idea of God. But in the beginning, it can be an idea of God. See, yes, I feel God is present. I feel the idea. Yes, God is loving me. I go to gallows knowing that He's sending me there. I have an idea, which is good. But you can also experience that He is present with you. That when you are being hanged, He is also being hanged at the same time. You can see He is with you. So, there are different forms of it, which are in the Veda described as the experiences of Sarama. Sarama is a faculty of experience of digging out something which is hidden and brought out before you. It's an experience of something dug out and given to you. That is the function of Sarma. Sarma is the one who finds out where the hidden cows are stolen and they are kept in the store. So, there is what is called suggestive intuition. You begin to feel there is the truth. I knock the door exactly at the right place. And there the knowledge which is secretly present I can draw out. This will happen automatically. Not by your seeking. Then there is revelation. In revelation, what is to be seen will be seen, will be revealed. There is a sight behind sight, not the physical sight, but you will see the truth. There is a sight behind the sight, drishti, drashta. That is because of Ila. Ila is the goddess of revelation. And if at this stage you worship Ila, then this power of revelation begins to become more and more manifest. Truths are revealed. What you are not able to see, at once you see within a short time. Sometimes even what is called in yogic experiences, you see the knowledge written down before your eyes. This also happens. Lipi. You can read before your eyes something that has to be, or you get a dream in which you can read your answer through the question. It's revealed to you in a second what you have been looking for. You have not been getting at all. You read 100 books and suddenly you knock, you go to sleep, and the dream, you read exactly the right thing to be read. And you get the knowledge. It's revealed. These experiences also are obtained. Or you have inspiration. This is where Veda speaks of Saraswati, in which the right word comes out suddenly from you. Like it is said Dato in his great exclamation, you remain immortal words. Odas, odas, ankor odas. Courage, courage, still courage. These are inspired words. They just come from above. The right word coming at the right moment. You are in that sense of inspiration. You reach that level where the right word automatically formulated words. As we know in the Vedas, rishis did not compose a word. The words came as it were formulated. That is inspiration. Now these powers begin to develop. All of these powers are powers of knowledge. No more ideas of the ordinary human mind. Human mind can't fabricate them. These are all ideas, they may be form of ideas, but these ideas are knowledge ideas, they are true. So this is the, when this is ripens a great deal, you can say now you have become intuitive. When this happens often, your mind, mental faculties become intuitive. You are no more only a rational thinker. You become a drashta, you begin to have shruti. These faculties begin to develop. But these are trickles. When you still go higher, then there is, as Sri Aurobindo points out, there are great doors of knowledge open. vistas of knowledge. A command, you can just open and get the knowledge. You don't have to make an effort, effortlessly, any science you want to understand. You just spend a little time, concentrate, and the knowledge is at your command. Now this may look very magical, but as Sri Aurobindo says, I'm not a philosopher and yet he wrote this book. How did he write all this? It's a fact. He says, I did not think about it. It all has come from above. How do you get it? But he says that you, such vistas of knowledge open. Now, Sri Aurobindo says that you multiply this kind of a capacity 100-fold and you get overmind. And you multiply 1,000,000-fold, it is supermind. So when Sri Aurobindo says that this capacity will be developed and there will be human beings who will automatically be possessed of supermind, not that they have to develop, like you and me, we have to struggle even to get one intuitive idea. But there will be a race of human beings who will have self-dispossessed knowledge. And so Sri Aurobindo says that these things, once you are entered into this field, then your problem is not getting the knowledge. Your problem then is only to put this knowledge into all parts of being where are resisting. So that even the body itself becomes supramental. That is the most important problem. What Sri Aurobindo and the mother were trying was to get that supramental knowledge in the atoms, in the cells of the body. So that even the cell becomes supramental. Cell becomes responsive to supramental knowledge. So it's a very vast program. So when you said, is there something beyond or between mind and supermind? So these are the different levels between mind and supermind. And but the basic point, effort is this fourfold as far as we are concerned. Afterwards, God himself takes charge of it. So it is left to him. But from our side, we have to do this much at least. Instead of merely sitting down to silence the mind, you do it from time to time, from hour to hour, but the rest of the time should be spent in other activities. And there are quite a lot. To be obedient, mind to be obedient, is a very difficult task. And to cultivate the faculty of the mind to its highest is also a difficult activity. And then to be all the time occupied with the highest occupation of life. To remain very occupied, the highest. So these are, if you are engaged, all the 24 hours are enough, not enough actually. And we can really be doing sadhana all the time. And these things should be told young people because all this will take a long time. So if young people know that all this is to be done, young people don't waste their time in doing many other things in which they are simply wasting their time. They can use their time rightly and profitably. So this knowledge has to be given to India. It was there in our Indian tradition, but it has been lost.
It has been elaborated in Synthesis of Law?
Yes.
Did this explain it?
Yes. There is a chapter called the Intuitive Mind. You read that chapter, Intuitive Mind, entitled Intuitive Mind. So these four methods have been described in great detail.
This is a new kind of yoga sutra.
Yeah, that is true. You are right, absolutely. You see, the yoga, the way in which yoga is being taught to our young people today is only bookish sort of thing. And people have not reconciled many ideas which are in currency. You do pranayama, and some say you do yama, niyama, and then you do this pratyahara, dharana, and even there we don't know what is the difference between the two, and how long it takes for you to go from pratyahara to dharana, from dharana to dhyana, and dhyana to samadhi. It takes, these are all long, long processes. So that is why there is a great deal of confusion in our country. This is the Vedic yoga actually. The Vedic rishis follow this path. And if you read all the Vedic mantras, this is a kind of a Shastric summary. But when this is sacrifice, prayer, and all kinds of dhimahi, there are also meditations of various kinds and contemplation and watch, rising to the higher levels. Also tantric sadhana, sahasrara. It's a tantric sadhana to go to sahasrara. So it's a real integrality. You bring all this together and you rise. What she was saying, that is when you fly, this is all accelerate, you accelerate and you rise up. In other words, it is true that this word meditation is not understood properly. What is meditation? What is concentration? What is contemplation? What is witnessing consciousness? What is silencing the mind? Now these words are used pell-mell. But there is a need to explain to people that each word has a specific meaning. Contemplation is not the same as meditation. Both are concentration. Concentration can be meditative or can be contemplative. Even the word concentration, there are many kinds of concentration. Even Ashtavadhani, for example, in Jainism, Shatavadhani, and they are also powers of concentration. How do they achieve this? They are also, and they are achieved. It's not fake.
No. They demonstrate it.
They demonstrate a fact. You develop these faculties, so you can't say that all this is of no use. But even they, if they want to explain what is concentration, apart from being sojavadhani, if you say now concentrate on something else, they won't be able to do it. They can't concentrate upon Atman. They can concentrate upon 100 subjects. But you say now you concentrate upon the Atman, upon Jivatman, they won't be able to do it. It requires what is the object of concentration and how do you hold the object into concentration? Multiplicity of objects, part of objects, the nature of the object, all this has very great importance in your learning of concentration meditation. When they say, for example, concentrate on the tip of your nose, how does it help you? It's not concentration on God or Atman or anything at all. It's concentrate on the tip of your nose. What do you do? Or you can say, concentrate from between the eyebrows. What do you do? What happens? People go on trying, they don't even know what is the meaning of it. The Shastra is not known. A few propositions are made and people are told, you do this, everything, as he said, rightly, do mantra, mantra jap karo. What is mantra jap? With what heart you should do, with what conditions you should do, what kind of life you should be leading. All this is not told. And therefore people seem to be wasting their time. In this world, fortunately, human being is such a nice instrument that whatever he does brings some result. From that point, like our present system of education, however bad it is producing good people ultimately. Nice people like Akhilesh and myself. It is this system of education that produces it. But it is not to justify the present system of education. In a sense, supposing if I say, Oh, present system of education is absolutely condemned. I may be justified in saying that. Depends upon what condition, in what condition, what context I am saying. Similarly, what he said is in that context. So what he said does not need to be rubbed out at all. What he says remains. At the same time, what you say also remains. It is also true. What she is saying is also true because she also has gone and she has found all of them useful. She can't say that it is all useless, not only. But as she said, ultimately I find a vacuum. What about that? If after doing all that you say, well, I remain quiet, I was very nice, I felt very relieved, there's lots of tensions went away from my mind. It's all useless? No, it is all good. But then what? Ultimately you meditate for what? I must have experience of myself. Not only merely quietude and remaining nice. A disease is aggravated by the conditions in which you normally live. You said that I am now taken to Vipassana. I go to Vipassana, conditions change. Actually speaking, as Mother says, all diseases are cured by faith. Fundamental. All diseases. Now if you apply this basic principle, you can say the moment a person's faith is changed, he becomes all right. In every case it doesn't happen because faith change is not easy.
But Uncle, another thing which I found is very conducive for cure is the slowing down of the mind.
Yes, you are so all right. Yes,
that is what is the alchemy which I found.
The faith begins to function better in the mind is quiet.
Quieter.
So that is also true. To say that Vipassana causes it is to equate one cause with an effect which is not causally effects. But there are other conditions which obtain as a result of which this happens. So if somebody says, I feel very happy, you should encourage it. Nobody's faith should be disturbed. People should always be told, if it helps you, please do it. And I'll be very happy. And so it's not a question. The point is only this much. Ultimate aim of meditation has to be fixed very clearly. Is it the attainment of the status of a siddha prajna? It's not disease or no disease and all of that. These are subordinate things. The important thing is, am I going to be siddha prajna because of meditation? And what kind of meditation? Do I become more equal-minded, very large-minded, noble, self-sacrificing, obedient? These qualities come into me. They automatically begin to flower into me. These are the objects of meditation. And then, of course, many capacities, as I said, many ideas, opening of the doors of knowledge. These are very high level of attainments. They also happen and they do come. If these things happen by any kind of meditation, I would say, fine, what is wonderful. If somebody says, goes to Vipassana and says, I was opened up a big store of knowledge. I entered there, I picked up a book. If you read Agenda of the Mother, how many times Mother says, I saw Satprem in a huge library of books where he was seated and he was looking for knowledge. Now, I mean, if this is what happens to somebody, I'll be very, very happy. If by doing Vipassana somebody says, I entered into their field, very good. There is no question of criticizing one thing or the other or one thing against the other. For example, Sri Chaitanya taught dancing. What's wrong about it? And yet when I go to Krishna temple, ISKCON temple, and people do, the higher the jump you make, the better you are as a sadhana, I only laugh at this. What is this? But what Sri Chaitanya says is very right. I understand it. You should have a real bhava of that kind. You should see Sri Krishna everywhere. And what a joy it is to see Sri Krishna in every field.
And the dance is not your effort. Here they jump. Because everybody said that you can jump very nicely, so your bhakti is very great. So, I think today we have become quite excessively late now.